Welcome to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast, with me, Ken MacDonald.
And with me, Tim Owen. Our guest for this episode is Francis Crook. Francis's current position in public life is as the co-convener of the Commission on Political Power. She founded the Commission in 2022 together with Baroness Frances D'Souza. And the purpose of this cross-party body is, according to the website, to generate a national debate on potential legislative and structural reform of our political system. It intends to examine what it describes as the linear structure of political power in the UK and to produce a roadmap for future reform aimed at enhancing legitimacy and democracy. Amongst other commissioners include former Labour MP Graham Allen and the former Conservative MPs Dominic Grieve and Rory Stewart. So the Commission is Frances's current focus, but in a previous phase of her life, she had a very prominent role in a crucial area of law and public policy, which Ken and I are very interested in and have been covering in the podcast series. For some 35 years, until 2021, Frances was the chief executive of the Howard League for Penal Reform, the oldest penal reform charity in the UK, and indeed a body of which Ken is currently president. During her leadership of the Howard League, Frances was responsible for its research programmes and campaigns to raise public concern about a whole range of prison issues, including suicide in custody, the overuse of custody, poor prison conditions, and the plight of mothers in prison. Under her direction, the number of staff and turnover of the charity increased some 20-fold, and the Howard League became the best-known campaigner in this field. And so today, however, we want to ask Frances about the work and ambition of the Commission on Political Power, but also to get her views on the latest round of proposals in the Queen's Speech, which concern sentencing and the role of the Parole Board in authorising the release of various categories of prisoner. These are both measures which will directly impact the prison population, and we raise some of these issues with our previous guest, the Lord Chancellor Alex Chalke. So, Frances, welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us, Frances.
So, Frances, just before we get cracking on the issues, just a few questions about how you ended up, firstly, in the Howard League and what's influenced you in the work you've done. I see from your Wikipedia entry you grew up in London. Your father was Jewish and had a successful business selling home movies and comedy films. You did history at Liverpool University, you qualified as a teacher, you were a Labour councillor for East Finchley, you worked for British section of Amnesty International, before in 86 you joined the Howard League as its director. So tell us first of all about your father's business selling home movies and comedy films. How did that work out?
I can't remember much about it. I mean, he'd been a conscientious objector during the war.
Oh, okay.
And being Jewish, that was quite unusual. So his pacifism was very strong. His sense of duty and responsibility and his moral centre was very strong. But he also was a bit rackety with women.
Ah, okay.
I had stepmothers and things. So and my parents divorced when I was quite young. So it was a slightly chaotic background, I'd say.
But it sounds like he was obviously, despite his rackety reputation, as you say, with women, he was a very political person.
Yes, he was. I remember him taking me to show me how to vote when I was quite young. He said, go with the Conservatives because they have the best cars, but then vote Labour.
Yeah. One of my wife's uncles, who's Jewish, was also a conscientious objector in the war. But as you say, I think it was pretty unusual for Jewish men.
I think it
for
was.
For obvious reasons, yeah. Yeah. So what was it about the Howard League, Frances? I mean, yeah, there you are. You graduate in history. You've obviously got political interest because you're a councillor. What was it about the Howard League that made you want to go and join it? And it was quite different, of course, in those days. It was a much smaller organisation.
Well, it was on the edge of collapse when I was appointed, which they made very clear to me. I mean, I think, you know, incarcerating people, taking people's freedom away from them, is the most awesome, awful thing we can do in this country. And the idea of detention was really horrific to me. Of course, it's nominative determinism, as the Today programme pointed out to me. Francis means freedom and means criminal. So free the criminals is obviously something that's born to do.
It's destiny.
It was destiny. I'd always been interested in the idea of incarceration in prison. As you say, it's very political.
But presumably you felt that some people needed to be locked up, if only for the safety of others.
Well, it's a difficult thing. Yes, I would say that. There are some people who I've met over the years who are clearly very dangerous and committed the most horrendous, awful crimes. But I would abolish prisons as they are, because they, and there's only Grendon that is any history of success.
That's Grendon Underwood, which is a therapeutic community idea, isn't it? It's, as you say, unique.
Well, it's a democratic therapeutic community. And that's really important because it engages people in decision-making about their lives. So it has a very low reoffending rate. Most prisons make crime worse. They make crime worse inside them and it makes crime worse outside them. So if you're going to have prisons, then you have to have completely different sorts of institutions for the very few people
who require custody for any length of time.
We'll come on to prisons, Francis, as I said in the introduction, in perhaps the second half of our discussion. But let's start with the Commission on Political Power. It's a body that some of our listeners may not know a great deal about. It's still in its early years. It was founded last year. You and Baroness Frances D'Souza, I think, were the inspiring founding members of it. Just tell us about what led you to set it up and how it operates.
Well, as you say, I'd worked for 30 years with government in one form or another, and I'd worked also in local government. And I'm a great fan of local government. I think local government works very well. But nationally, this was the time when Boris Johnson was prime minister, when there was, you know, he tried to prorogue parliament. There was national chaos. And of course, we'd had the experience of the pandemic. And it was clear that things were going very wrong. We were also looking at big change it was at a time when obviously the Queen was coming to an end. And there'd be a new monarchy. So it was a period of chaos, but also impending great change. So my interest in politics and trying to make things better was really the trigger for trying to set something up, which is, there's a small organisation. We have very little money. It may well only last for a few years. But as you said in the introduction, it's really about trying to intervene in the public debate, getting people and politicians to think about what the options are for change, how we can make central government function slightly better. And we're working with lots of other organisations. It's a crowded field. So, you know, we're sharing our ideas.
So what you do, in effect, is that you publish a series of options papers on different, I suppose, what might be described as different constitutional issues, but making clear what options are and sometimes choosing between them. And you've looked at things like reform of the executive, reform of the head of state, possible creation of a Senate, increasing citizens' engagement with political power. And people can see all of this work on your website, on the Commission for Political Power website. But should we just as an example take one which we've discussed before on the podcast and which may become relevant if the Labour Party says what it's going to do in its first term, which is to reform the House of Lords. Your options papers call in effect for the creation of a Senate in the place of the House of Lords. Now, when most people talk about House of Lords reform, the first thing they start to talk about is elections and creating an elected second chamber. You don't come down on that side. You're not calling for an elected second chamber. You're talking about reform of another sort. Do you want to explain that, Francis? We should say that your co-founder, Francis D'Souza, is a former Speaker of the House of Lords, so she's very familiar with the institution.
She is, yes. Two Francises. I thought that would be a formidable option. We started off with a blank sheet. We know there are problems, and we knew that with the House of Lords that there's going to be change. As you say, I think the Labour Party is committed to some kind of change. And people are all assuming oh, that's got to be a directly elected body. And people are starting to think about, well, how would you have those elections? So the Metro mayors are pushing very hard for regional representation. Some people are pushing for some form of proportional representation. We stood back and said, well, hang on, democratic representation and accountability doesn't necessarily mean direct elections. You could have indirectly elected people from different constituencies to make sure there's proper representation. So we could have the Metro mayors automatically in the Senate. They've been elected. They don't need to be elected again. We could have local council leaders sitting by rotation, rather like the bishops do at the moment, because they're not elected, but local council leaders, which would make sure that you have really up-to-date knowledge and experience of what's going on in local government from across the country. And that would give you local as well as regional representation. You could bring in expertise. The one thing that the House of Lords is really good at the moment is it is a body with real expertise, legal, medical, all sorts of wonderful people do some really good work there, which we want to keep. So you could have the head of the BMA or the Nurses Union or the Steelworkers Union represented. They've been elected. So that would give you some indirect elected people.
I mean, the key role of the House of Lords is a scrutinising role. And again, we've discussed this before, but the quality of the legislation that comes up from the House of Commons, because it's debated so briefly and in such a cursory way, tends to be very poor. And the real central constitutional role of the House of Lords is to revise it and to propose suggestions for improvements and amendments and so on. And it seems to me that the key argument against direct elections is that if the House is directly elected, it's more likely to become a strictly party political animal, a whipped animal. And it's difficult to see how a whipped chamber is consistent with a chamber that properly scrutinises, because the government would simply whip all of its bills through as they're whipped through the House of Commons, and the element of scrutiny would be lost. I mean, that's a key argument against direct elections and a completely party political chamber mirroring, in essence, the House of Commons, isn't it?
Yes, that's pretty much the view that the Commission came to, that you would just be replicating the problems that you have in the Commons into a second chamber. So if you have a chamber that is different, but enhanced with some more, with better democratic legitimacy, we also think that it should be very clear what its purpose is. It's not a club or a sinecure. You know, it's not just poncing around in a row. Its purpose should be to uphold and protect the Constitution and the rights of citizens. So it should be made very explicit what its role is. And then its function should be to scrutinise and revise legislation, as you say.
I mean, on the basis, as you've said, that, as Candice pointed out, the current problem is the extremely poor quality of scrutiny of legislation by the House of Commons. Aren't you likely, if you're trying to achieve some measure of what you call representative democracy, albeit without direct elections, if you're going to try and recruit a rotation system, as the paper says, of elected mayors and council leaders, I mean, with the greatest respect to elected mayors and council leaders, aren't they going to be very much the same as the current members of the House of Commons, whose ability to scrutinise is frankly not very good at all? It isn't the reality, is that what we need is a highly competent Senate or second chamber, whatever you want to call it, of real experts who will do this job of scrutiny. I mean, you could reduce the House of Lords or the body by two-thirds to achieve a much tighter group of people, but people with real expertise who could do this job effectively. They would be able to conduct the kind of delaying, the delaying of rushed, ill-considered legislation, but they wouldn't be able ultimately to overrule it or reject it.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, our indirectly elected people would form part of the cohort of people there, but there would be enhanced appointments commission would be able to appoint members of the public and experts and other people to sit in the Senate as well. So it would be a sort of hybrid body with a collection of different expertise to do exactly as you say, Tim.
I mean, the House of Lords itself has already supported the idea of measures such as retirement ages, term limits, required levels of attendance and so on. I mean, the reality is there are about 400, 450 people in the House of Lords out of the 800 or 900 who play an active role. And there's no reason why the chamber should be any larger than that. My suspicion is that, I may be wrong about this, but my suspicion of this is that Keir Starmer will go for the sort of reforms that have already been proved to be acceptable in the House of Lords, which is those sorts of term limits, perhaps abolishing the Prime Minister's right to create his or her own list and to beef up the Appointments Commission so that it has a power of veto. Whether he finds time in his first term for very, very radical measures, we'll have to wait and see. Francis, I wonder whether we might move on to the question of prisons, which of course is something that's very dear to your heart, and we touched on earlier. We had on as our guest a couple of weeks ago the Secretary of State for Justice, Lord Chancellor Alex Chalke, and we were discussing with him some of the proposals that were trailed in the King's speech, and these include some proposals that are likely to increase the numbers of prisoners, but also some which are likely to decrease the numbers of prisoners, and we'll have to see where the balance ends. It seems to me he's made a sort of bargain, particularly with the Conservative electorate, which is to say, look, I want to stop some of the more trivial people ending up in prison, so I have this proposal to create a presumption that all prison sentences under 12 months will be suspended. But in order to achieve that, I'll satisfy you with some red meat and I will bang up things at the top end. So more whole life sentences for wider categories of crime, no longer being reserved for the very, 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 very worst. And I will cut remission or abolish remission in sex cases, serious sex cases and rape cases, because that's the kind of red meat you like as well. So this seems to me to be a kind of devil's bargain. And we could end up with more people in prison rather than less. And so it looks as though he had the right idea and then failed to, in the end, have the courage of his own convictions, this is my view, and chucked in the red meat too. I mean, what's your analysis of this?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's a bit of a mess. I mean, the good news is on the short sentences, because a lot of people with chaotic lives, mental health problems, drug addiction, who basically, it's people who are poor, are sent to prison for short periods of time, which is very distressing for them, and it doesn't do anybody any good. And it's very, it causes chaos in the prisons because people go in and out, and they go in and out often several times. So it doesn't solve any problems. Of course, I've started to write about things randomly on a Substack account. And I recently went to Liverpool, and the homelessness in our cities is just appalling. And they are the people who end up often in prison for short sentences. And talking to a magistrate recently, and she said that the homeless people come into her court for minor offences, asking to go to prison because they're cold and hungry. So the short sentences, if we could transfer some of that money to solving problems to do with drug addiction, mental health and homelessness, it might be a good thing. Of course, that's not going to happen, particularly if the prison population goes up, because of the, as you say, the other element of the legislation, the proposed legislation, is to keep people in prison for very much longer, to serve out the whole of their sentence in prison. And I saw an article in the Telegraph, which assumed that that would mean 3,000 more prison places at a cost of $3 billion. The Telegraph reported it would lead to higher reoffending. And that's because if you send somebody to prison for 10 years for a serious crime, a sex offence, and they are released immediately from Wandsworth or somewhere, one of the closed prisons, straight onto the streets, there's no period of transition from a closed, really frightening and violent sordid, filthy, rat-infested prison to going back onto the streets. People are going to commit more crimes because there's no transition period. There'll be no supervision. There'll be just a cliff edge to their sentence, which is potentially extremely dangerous for them and for their potential victims.
When you retired from the Howard League in summer of 2021, you wrote an article that was published in The Guardian, which began by the first sentence said, "Nobody really cares about prisons. They're so far removed from the experience of most people, and they're apparently full of horrid people." And you say, "But prisons matter." And you say, as a chief executive of the Howard League for 35 years, reforming prisons has become my life's mission. But that you said that in October 2021, you would leave your work with one sad but inescapable conclusion. Prisons are the last unreformed public service stuck in the same cycle of misery and futility as when I arrived. So, I mean, that was very much, I suppose, a cry of desperation. And one thing I wanted to raise with you, it's an issue that we brought up in the podcast before. The sheer number of turnover of Lord Chancellors and Prisons Ministers, in particular since 2010. We've had in the last 13 years 11 Lord Chancellors and probably as many Prisons Ministers. So the people stick around for 1 year if they're lucky. And some of them have been truly appalling. I think of Chris Grayling and Liz Truss, Dominic Raab, to name but three. You dealt, presumably over those 35 years at the Howard League, with numerous cabinet ministers and prisons ministers and so on. I mean, is the complete lack of continuity of policy and seriousness on the part of the politicians partly to blame?
Well, lack of continuity is an issue, but of course it depends who's continuing. Had Chris Grayling continued in post for even longer, it would have been a complete disaster. Yeah.
Fair point.
So, you know, get rid of people, that's a good thing. And I'm going to pick you up on one thing. I mean, Liz Truss was actually quite a good Lord Chancellor.
Really?
She tried in her short period. She was only there for a few months.
I don't think the judges agree with that.
Well, no, she didn't like the judges. That's true. But then, you know, that's not my job. What she tried to do was to stop recalls to prison. She sent out new guidance, which was trying to restrict the powers to recall people to prison for administrative reasons. So, because the scandal is that people get released under probation supervision, but get recalled back to prison because they didn't turn up to an appointment. Well, people lead rackety lives. Stuff happens. People are being recalled in their tens of thousands. And then they languish in prison for another few months. And she tried to stop that. So I always give credit to people when they try to do something good.
It is true that we've rather focused, when we've talked about Liz Truss in that office, on her attitude towards the judges, which we, many other people, have found wanting. But she was a bit more interesting when it came to prison policy. But I think Tim makes a fair point, doesn't he, Francis? I mean, reforming prisons is a big, hard job that's not going to be done overnight. And if you have a series of Lord Chancellors, none of whom have this as a particular priority, and all of whom are simply firefighting, trying to keep the numbers to a place where they can actually be housed rather than stuck into police cells, if they're focused on that as their main prison policy, then nothing's going to happen, is it? There's no one has really stood back and had a broad look at prisons and what might be done about them. I mean, Ken Clark used to think about it, I think. Didn't actually in the end do very much. But there's been no one holding that office who's sort of stood back and had a big panoramic look at prisons as an institution in our civil society and what to do about them.
No, I think that's right. Michael Gove did try from a sort of very immoral point of view. And he talked about a redemption, which is not something that other chancellors have done before, and secretaries of state. So that was at least an attempt. When I looked at it, as a voluntary organisation like the Howard League, you know, we were never going to have a big impact. What I tried to do there was to stop people going in the first place. And I'm going to claim some success here, because Labour brought in sanction detection targets for the police, which meant that the police had to arrest lots of people. So they arrested lots of children. And we found that hundreds of thousands of children were arrested for being annoying, because we all know that teenagers are annoying, but you don't arrest them for that. So I worked with the police to stop them arresting children for being annoying. And it was dramatically successful. So we went down from an indication is from 300,000 child arrests in a year to 70,000. And you could see that going through the system. So that under Labour, you had 3,000 children in prisons. And by the end of this work with the police, we only had 500. Now, that's still too many children in prison, but it's a dramatic reduction. And so if you can work at the front end, it's a bit like primary care. You work at primary care to stop people ending up in hospital unnecessarily. So you can reduce the use of prison. If you can reduce the numbers, then you can do something about the institutions.
Can I just come back a bit about on that? Because one of the reasons the Labour government did all that was because of the huge concern in the early noughties, early mid to noughties up to 2010, about antisocial behaviour, particularly on social housing estates, where groups of, I suppose you might call them children, although some of them will have been 15, 16, were causing tremendous upset and distress to people, you know, setting fire to abandoned cars, graffiti, taking drugs, noise, threats, mugging. I mean, tremendous upset caused by this kind of behavior. And the government, I suppose, felt it was responding to that with the whole regime for antisocial behavior disorders and for arrest targets for the police. So it didn't come out of nowhere. There was a great kind of popular pressure on the government to do something about this disorder, which was wrecking many people's lives. So there is another side to this, isn't there?
Yes, but I think Labour has understood that you don't arrest your way out of antisocial behaviour. You don't criminalise people. You can deal with crime disorder and alienation by young people by investing in education, by youth workers, activities by repairing lifts and all sorts of things. The Americans tried it in what they call million-dollar blocks, where they took money out of prisons. They closed prisons, for example, in New York State, and invested that money instead in local areas, which dramatically reduced antisocial behaviour. So they did, you know, play parks, and they gave local people the money and the power over the money. So you can do that without bringing in antisocial behaviour orders, which were actually counterproductive and very damaging to young people, because they got a criminal record, which is there for life.
You describe how working with the police forces produced good results in stopping, if you like, the number of people being arrested and then eventually ending up in custody. But to what extent did the Howard League and if you take the Prison Reform Trust, which is another a prominent prison penal reform charity, to what extent did you feel during your time as director of the Howard League that you ever had the ear of government? I mean, how does it work? Would Howard League or the Prison Reform Trust be invited in for discussions with government? Or was it just a question of very much acting on the sidelines, so to speak, and criticising and putting forward reform proposals, but without any sense that you were being listened to?
I think we got listened to. I met Secretaries of State. I met prison ministers. We worked with select committees. We worked with individual MPs, senior MPs. We worked with various different departments. It's not, of course, not just criminal justice, but also health. And the Health Select Committee on mental health issues. So there was quite, and civil servants, of course. So there was quite a lot of contact. Being a relatively small organisation, the Howard League, you know, 20 staff, turnover of a million, it's compared to other charities, it was very small. But we because we didn't take government contracts and government money, we were completely independently funded. But we were we tried to divide the world up with Prison Reform Trust, who we work with quite closely. There's good relationships across the children's charities and the criminal justice charities. There are lots of different people working in different ways. So that's why we tried to concentrate on front-end stuff, on trying to stop people going in. Prison Reform Trust tended to work with longer-term prison issues. So actually, that worked quite well. We complemented each other. So our concentration was working with the police at preventing people getting in to prison. So we identified, as Ken will know, work on gambling that was getting people into prison. We found a woman who was working as a cleaner in WH Smith's and was stealing scratch cards. And ended up, because she was addicted to this, the scratch cards. So if you can stop that happening, it's good for the retailer, it's good for the...
Sorry, was she sent to prison?
Yes.
Unbelievable. It's just unbelievable.
Because
hang on, Francis, there's someone in that situation. I mean, obviously, I don't know her, I don't know her record or the full details of the case, but, I mean, this is the problem, isn't it? That we have people with these sorts of disorders and addictions and illnesses, too many of them in prison. Obviously, too many of them in prison.
Absolutely. And if you can prevent that happening and you can get support and help, then you can prevent people from going into prison in the first place. And then you've got prisons, which are for people who've committed really serious, nasty offences and potentially very dangerous. And you can completely change the nature of the prison itself and make them more like Brendan Underwood, which is a democratic therapeutic prison. And if a prison is said to work, it works.
Can we move on to the question of parole and the reforms or the changes which were heralded in the Queen's speech and which are now set out in the Victims and Prisoners Bill? And I was reading through the explanatory notes to this legislation, and it's an incredibly depressing fact that, unfortunately, Alex Chalk, I really question whether he actually believes in it or whether he's just faced with having to inherit these proposals which were initiated by Dominic Raab in his so-called root and branch review document issued in 2022. But I mean, it's an incredibly depressing array of provisions, none of which, as far as I can see, is remotely necessary to amend the way the parole board works in circumstances where the parole board is a highly specialised body. Its record of releasing prisoners is extraordinarily good, in the sense that the number of people who reoffend or commit further dangerous offences is incredibly low. And this is a classic example of government throwing red meat to its conservative right-wing bench and to the tabloid press to appear to be being tough. I mean, we can perhaps go through some of these proposals, but the idea is they're going to change the test for release in a meaningless way. They're going to ensure that effectively more law enforcement people are on the parole board, and that mainly prison officers, police officers or ex-police officers, it would seem. For certain offenders described as the top tier cohort of people who've committed the most serious offences, the Lord Chancellor is now going to reserve to himself the ability to overturn a parole board decision on the basis that he and his civil servants know better than the parole board. And then there's a ludicrous, cumbersome arrangement whereby if the Secretary of State overturns a parole board release decision in relation to this top-tier cohort, then the prisoner can go to the upper tribunal and appeal the Secretary of State's decision. I mean, that whole thing is just insane. What's your view about what's going on with the parole board?
I think it's actually potentially quite risky. Mm. It's politicising the parole process,
yep,
and the parole board.
Yep.
And I think that's potentially risky because at the moment, I'm quite political by background. I'm not a lawyer. But at the moment, the Secretary of State can blame the parole board if they appear to get something wrong. Whereas if he reserves unto himself these powers and something goes wrong, he's the one that's going to be blamed. So I actually think it's probably counterproductive. And it's politicising Robert. He's bringing unto himself the power to sack the head of the parole board, which I think is quite dangerous. I think it's very risky. It's a mess, as you say. It's a complete mess. And it will cause all sorts of problems. The other point about parole, of course, is just to remember that people have to prove they're safe. So it's a very, very high bar. It's very difficult to get parole. And one of the big problems with parole is I don't think they release enough people rather than they release too many.
I mean, Tim's right. What's really depressing about this is that it's an attack on a system that's actually working quite well, and it's an attack which is entirely political. There's no justice merit in it. It's entirely political. It is, as you say, Francis, extraordinarily difficult to get parole. The bar is very, very high, and they almost always get it right. I mean, of course, no system is completely perfect, but the idea it's going to be made more perfect by having people like Dominic Raab make final decisions about whether people should stay in prison or not seems to me to be absolutely risible.
Get it right because they're so risk averse.
Yeah.
I mean, they release very, very few people compared to the number of people who are eligible and who go to hearings. The number of people who get released is a very few. So perhaps I think that's where the problem lies.
Yeah. And finally on this, Francis, the other provision, which I wish I'd known about when we had Alex Chalk on the programme a few weeks ago, another provision, which is similar perhaps to what they're kind of come up with now in relation to the Rwanda policy, a way of disapplying the Human Rights Act apparently being considered in relation to the Rwanda policy. They're having a proposal in this Victim and Prisoners Bill to disapply Section 3 of the Human Rights Act so that if incompatibilities are said to arise with the new parole measures or any of the other release measures, the courts will not be under the obligation to interpret the provisions compatibly with the Human Rights Act. And the purpose of this provision is to avoid courts adopting what is said to be a strained Section 3 interpretation, which, according to the explanatory notes, would ultimately disregard the policy intention of the release regime. But of course, what it's going to mean is yet more potential litigation in Strasbourg, so long as we remain members of the convention. And it's just an extraordinary provision, in my view.
It's all very weird. I mean, a government that says that we are a party of law and order is saying, yes, well, we're law and order, but we don't like the laws that we've made. We don't like the laws of the land, and we're going to circumvent them, ignore them, or bring in new laws so that we can avoid them. I mean, to try to do that is a bit like what happens in Russia, in Putin's Russia. It's very worrying.
Well, let's see if this goes through, this stuff, how much of it, I suspect not very much, will be unwound by a future Labour government. Francis, thank you very much for joining us. It's been very interesting. Good to see you again, and good luck with the work of the commission.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
Yes, good luck, Francis.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with Tim Owen and me, Ken MacDonald. Do join us again. We'll be with you regularly leading up to Christmas and beyond into the new year. Please leave us a review, follow the podcast, share it with your friends. Thank you for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you again soon.
Our editor is Billy Lawrence, and our social media advisor is Jess Jones. We'll see you soon.